There you go. Kind of a long introduction there. This is Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, and Josh, of course. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's up?
Beautiful day out there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very depressing.
well, you want to be skiing.
Yeah, I want to be skiing.
I want to be out working in the garden.
No, and I don't like spring skiing. I like it single digits, five below to five above. But at any rate, what do we got lined up?
We have Jack Clark.
What do we got? That sounds like, I'm sorry, that sounds like some stupid sports show. What do we got? I'm sorry, Josh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We have Jack Clark, the Director of Policy at Mass Audubon Society. We have Dr. Cynthia Lynch, who's the Vice President of Institutional Advancement at Salem State University. And we have Bob Gravino, who's a retired gentleman from the Coast Guard and Public Works Director, and works on for many in a volunteer capacity for many charitable groups.
All right, sounds good. We'll have all that and more coming right up.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sauk Asian Sportswear handles all aspects of your needs, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SaukAsianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sauk Asian Sportswear is the place to go.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Jack Clark. Jack, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Glad to.
Well, you know, you and I have talked on previous occasions and on other shows, so I'm familiar with your background, but it'd be helpful if you'd give us a little bit of your background for the listening audience.
Sure. I've lived in Gloucester for about 30 years. My wife, Farrah Courtney, and I raised a daughter here. Started in first grade at West Parish through the high school. She's now up in Berwick, Maine, living with her husband, Brian, who's at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, and my two grandchildren.
Ah.
I worked for the National Park Service as a ranger for 10 years, worked for three governors in the Environmental Affairs Office, and have been with Mass Audubon now for about 23 years.
Great. Now, you've been really a world traveler in some respects. I know that you've done work internationally in environmental affairs and so forth with Israel and Ireland. Anything that you can share with us about those ventures?
That's right. I had an opportunity to spend some time in Northern Ireland, on an island called Rathlin. And it's the only inhabited island off the North Irish coast. And I was working with an international team of environmentalists invited by Northern Ireland to help them sort out a number of issues regarding gentrification of their island, things we see in Gloucester, loss of traditional culture, ways of being, and they wanted to be able to certainly promote economic development, but not lose Rathlin being Rathlin. Then the other trip I had the opportunity to participate in was I was invited by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston to join 10 environmentalists in Israel, and we spent some time there working with Palestinians, working with Israelis and others
Now, you've been, I'm sure, let me step back from that. I guess the question I'd want to pose is, how has the national election and the election of Donald Trump impacted, or how is it perceived as going to impact the work that you do?
Well, the president's comments during the campaign and during this month-long transition have been, I would say, not somewhat, but very hostile toward the environment in terms of rolling back environmental protections, scaling back the staff funding at the Environmental Protection Agency in particular. You know, the Environmental Protection Agency is the first and foremost, Josh, a public health agency. And what they do is protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land we live, work, and play on. And to make choices regarding false choices, by the way, about jobs and economic development versus the public health, I think is a false choice. And so we're working with our congressional delegation, our senators. I met on Wednesday with Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey and her chief staff in her office, in which we were laying out a strategy for protecting the natural security and the environmental legacy we have in this country from any kind of repeal or rollbacks.
Okay. Now, in the campaign, what I picked up was, of course, what's said in the campaign and what actually happens is sometimes different. The Environmental Protection Agency is, if memory serves me, was created by Richard Nixon.
Yes, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency was passed. The law establishing it was passed in 1972 by a bipartisan Congress, and signed into law by GOP President Richard Nixon. It established not only the National Environmental Policy Act, established not only the agency for enforcement of these environmental and health rules and regulations, but also established the environmental review process by which major projects undergo a review to determine what, if any, the impacts on the environment and the health of the American people might be. Critical law, really sacrosanct in terms of protecting Americans' health and environment.
It's interesting when you look at issues in on a national front that are thought to be of one party, and yet you see another party is leading the way. Teddy, the first real conservation efforts in this country came from Teddy Roosevelt as president.
It did. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, who really helped with helping establish the national parks, what might many call America's best idea, and I was happy to serve as a park ranger for a decade with that agency. The protection of the public's health, the protection of our parks, our oceans, are not bipartisan.
No.
When we look at protecting fisheries, really important for Gloucester that we have smart rules that protect our community, protect our way of life, protect our industry, and provide for sustainable harvest. We need strong bipartisan leadership in Washington regarding that sort of thing. You know, when the president said last week for every two regulations he's going to do away with one, let's take the regulations we have that provide for sustainable fishery in Gloucester. Which ones are you going to do away with?
Yeah.
I just don't see it. You know, if we have regulations protecting the air we breathe, the water we drink, we're going to do away with one of those. You pick which one we need to do away with, and our families and children will not be happy with that. You know, we've made some real successes over the last 40, 45 years in terms of the public's health, our way of being, and the quality of our life as a result of, I'll call them, community standards that protect us.
Well, Ronald Reagan was big when he was governor of California and then later as president of trying to to tone down the amount of bureaucracy that exists. And, you know, when I was in educational administration, there was a binder, half an inch, 2.5 inches thick, that gave everything that you could do for Title I. And Title I was maybe $180,000. So you get a $30 million budget, but that you know, you have maybe a half a dozen policies of how you spend that and what you have to do, and then you have a. So I understand in some respects things that seem overburdensome. Environment's a different story, of course, but I get the flavor of it. The thing that came up in the election, and again, there's always the rhetoric of the election is different than what they're actually going to do, but it pointed to the idea that the Environmental Protection Agency was created to be a global guide or the national guide, but that much of the regulations were to be borne by the individual states. And I got the impression that the Trump administration, at least from what they were putting out there, was, you know, less federal regulation and more control to the states. Is that right, or is that just the rhetoric of a campaign and not really how it plays out when you get to policy change?
Really good question, Josh. And it's one that I discussed with the Attorney General on Wednesday, and one which is being discussed in the halls of Congress and in the states all over. You know, we looked to the Environmental Protection Agency in the 1970s and since then to provide some national standards in terms of clean air and clean water and cleaning up hazardous waste sites. And that's important, you know. And we also encourage states to do their job. And that focus on the federal government providing standards and overseeing water quality and that sort of thing was really important. But now that we see the federal government backing off, we're looking more at the states' rights and this kind of federalism where it's the states that are now going to have to step up and have standards that are important, you know. And of course, most recently, we look at the failure of Michigan in Flint to protect the drinking water for children and families.
Yeah.
In that state. And it was the federal government that was to oversee, but they provided the state with the opportunity to test lead in drinking water. There needs to be a partnership. It's going to be a balance between the state interest and the federal interest. And that goes back to the founding of our nation, the debates between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson on the national executive branch versus the ability of states to do the job. And that's kind of a healthy debate that's going on today. But we cannot have the states, we cannot have the federal government not partnering to protect the nation's health.
Well, I guess, you know, one of the spin-off questions that must be of concern to you, the Attorney General, and the governor also, is that as you shift responsibility to the states, there's a cost attached to that. And so whether if it's now up to the state of Commonwealth of Massachusetts or the other states to drive what happens or doesn't happen in the environment, with residential or industrial uses, then doesn't that mean there's more cost that they're going to have to deal with? And if that happens, where does that come from and at what expense?
Absolutely. Another great question, and one we're debating today. As the legislature, as Beacon Hill lawmakers begin crafting their fiscal year 2018 budget. In Massachusetts, we have a $40 billion budget. At least 1% of it should be devoted to environmental protection. And right now in the budget, we're at 0.56. The governor filed his budget 3 weeks ago, and the environmental budget was at 0.53% of the $40 billion budget. Massachusetts has not put 1% toward the budget since 2009. We need to step it up as we expect Washington to curtail its funding for environmental enforcement at the state and regional level through the Environmental Protection Agency. Then we're going to be relying on the states. And here in Massachusetts, we have to step it up and provide more money for environmental protection.
What is your sense? The head of the Environmental Protection Agency, his name again is what?
Scott Pruitt.
Huh?
Scott Pruitt was just confirmed last week.
Yeah, okay. I was going to lead into a joke, but I'll actually step back from that. I guess the question is, to what extent do you think the agenda is to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency, or water it down to such an extent that that it's dysfunctional?
Well, Myron Ebel, who headed the transition team before Mr. Pruitt was confirmed, said that we have 15,000 employees throughout the country at the Environmental Protection Agency. We're going to cut that down to 5,000. The president said we're going to reduce the number of health benefit standards that the agency has promulgated. A bill has been filed in the House of Representatives to do away with the EPA. Mr. Pruitt, as former Attorney General in Oklahoma, filed 16 lawsuits against the Environmental Protection Agency, mostly over clean air standards. And so we don't think the Environmental Protection Agency is going to step up and do the job to protect the American people. So it's going to have to be the states. So it doesn't look good at EPA. But we have to watch, and we have to let our lawmakers, both in the Senate and the House, know that we care about protecting the nation's health.
Okay, got just a few more minutes, and I wanted to, I know that you were involved, you've been an architect and writer in various drafts of significant legislation, both at the state and national level. Can you share with us some of that work and what that entailed?
I helped draft and pass what's really important to Gloucester and 171 other communities, the Community Preservation Act. So that's a piece of legislation I worked on for many years, both at the State House and then in here in Gloucester to get it passed. I was also instrumental in helping draft and pass the Massachusetts Ocean Management Act, and Governor Baker last year appointed me as chairman of the State Ocean Advisory Commission. So we're partnering with the governor in that, really important for Gloucester and for a place we call the Bay State, managing our ocean resources. Also helped draft and pass the Wetlands Protection Act, Rivers Protection Act, and a host of other environmental and coastal related bills.
There's I saw in your bio you did work on the guidelines for barrier beach management. I know that you can't simplify it too much, but what does that involve?
Yeah, barrier beaches are these long strips of sand, usually connected to the mainland, like Good Harbor Beach, Plum Island, Cranes. These are highly dynamic beaches. People love going to recreate at them. Off-road vehicles on Cape Cod National Seashore, down on the Cape, South Shore, endangered species, vulnerable to storm overwash and erosion. And so a real conflict in terms of recreation versus conservation on these beaches. And my job when I was with the Weld Administration was to chair a task force made up of all the various interest groups in the Commonwealth to come up with a set of guidelines to help cities and towns manage their beaches. And that worked out very successfully. And most recently, the Supreme Judicial Court mentioned these guidelines last year in an opinion to the legislature that was requested. So a really relevant document. Okay. And one of the things I recommended this week is that I recommended it this week to one of our city councilors, is that we have so many different issues going on with Gloucester beaches. I think it's time for Gloucester to have a beach commission appointed by the mayor, confirmed by the council, with a clear set of tasks on how we need to look at the conflicts, the myriad interests, and the success and popularity of Gloucester's beaches, so they can continue to be part of our lifeblood and somewhat of our economic engine in the summer in terms of income. We need to keep them healthy, vibrant, safe, and clean.
I know I have to go, but maybe another time or even privately you could tell me a little bit about dredging and what's involved in that and why that's so difficult, expensive, and to do. And maybe we can have you back in a couple of months or as your schedule allows, and we can get into a few more issues.
Absolutely. We'd love to do it, Josh, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning.
Thank you, Jack. Have a good day.
All right,
take care.
You.
Bye-bye.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
The Institution for Savings has always believed in giving back to our communities because our communities are such great places to live and work. Last year alone, we donated and pledged more than $3.9 million to local nonprofits, including local hospitals, schools, food pantries, art organizations, and more. Named one of Boston Business Journal's top philanthropic companies, we are proud to be your local hometown bank. InstitutionForSavings.com. Member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Many aspects of estate planning are interrelated, and you can turn to attorney Bob Andruga for full-service estate planning to help you develop a comprehensive plan in providing for your future. Bob will work with you through the years to adapt your plan as needed, and he can assist you with managing wills, trust, probate, and taxes. Visit the law offices of Robert J. Andruga at 128 Main Street, Gloucester, or call today for an appointment at 978-283-6883.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our second guest is Dr. Cynthia McGurran, who's the Vice President of Institutional Advancement at Salem State University. Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Josh, so pleased to be with you.
Well, we usually start out and ask our guests to give us a little bit of your background. I know I've read your bio here, and it's very significant, but if you share some of the highlights with us, then we want to talk about some of the things that the good things you folks are doing at Salem State.
Absolutely. I have been fortunate enough to be at Salem State University for 30 years. I started my career here as the Director of Public Relations back in 1983 and served in a couple different positions, another as Special Assistant to the President for External Affairs when Nancy Harrington was president here.
Okay.
And I have been in this position, which is Vice President of Institutional Advancement, since 2004. Now, a lot of people would say, what is institutional advancement? And it's really oversight of all of our fundraising efforts, our relationships with alumni, our special events that are related to fundraising, our, I serve as executive director of the Salem State University Foundation, which is the 501c3 that all public institutions need to have in order to accept private funds into the public institution.
Great. You've been involved in a program there called Salem State's 10,000 Reasons campaign that I'm understanding raised $26 million. Tell us about that, and what did that involve?
This was an extraordinarily significant campaign for Salem State. I know that $26 million doesn't necessarily sound like a significant amount of money when you hear over and over again about private institutions and how their campaigns are in the billions of dollars. But $26 million, and it was really the goal, which was a five-year campaign, the goal of the five-year campaign was $25 million. And that was a significant amount of money to raise for a public institution in Massachusetts, particularly where we kind of fall in the shadows of all of the many private institutions that are here. But it has really changed the culture of philanthropy among our alumni, of whom we have 66,000, 25,000 of whom live in Essex County. So it's changed the culture of philanthropy, not only for our alumni, but also for our employees. And so it's been very significant in that way. It was also a comprehensive campaign, meaning that it wasn't just about, let's raise money for a certain school, or previously we had a small campaign to raise money for a Center for Creative and Performing Arts, which actually happened during this campaign. But the comprehensive nature of it was really about our commitment to students, a campaign for scholarships, financial assistance, which is extraordinarily important to our students, and then a commitment to faculty and academic programs. And then a fourth component was just putting in place a long-term plan for unrestricted annual support, which just helps the university to meet the needs of, that come up every year that aren't necessarily we're able to project.
Sure. Now, there are some milestones, I understand, coming up that are of interest to surrounding communities contiguous to the university. Can you share with us a little bit about that? Hello.
Well, as part of this campaign, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
As part of this campaign, we were able to complete our long-term project to build a Center for Creative and Performing Arts, which is opening in April, and it's being named for one of our significant donors. It's going to be named the Sophia Gordon Center for Creative and Performing Arts. And it was a total renovation and redevelopment of the Main Stage Theater, which is on Lafayette Street in Salem, which thousands and thousands of people to see some of our fabulous performances that are put on by our theater students and our faculty. And there have also been musical performance in there and creative and performing, creative writing readings. So it's really been, I think, a social hub for the arts for the region and certainly for the institution. And now it's just going to be this wonderful state-of-the-art, I think, just, attraction for everyone to come to. So it's going to be opening the weekend of April 22nd, and we'll be running again the following weekend. The first performance is going to be of The Drowsy Chaperone, which is a musical within a comedy, from what I understand.
Okay. And having a better, more current and renovated facility, how is that going to impact the curriculum in terms of what's offered? Or are you going to be able to expand or capitalize on that in terms of the offerings for students, and if so, how?
Well, I don't think that we're going to be expanding the current programs that we offer our students, which are pretty extensive.
Okay.
know that there is a complete listing of on our website, salemstate.edu, that talks about what's offered through theater. But it's not just about acting. It's also about directing, and it's about the technical aspects of theater, lighting and sound and stage design, and all of those elements are going to be integrated into this new facility. And one of the exciting things is that they used to have to build the sets, literally, build the sets on the stage so that no one could use the facility. No one. Meaning you couldn't hold meetings there, you couldn't have, you know, open forums that everyone could go to, external symphonies or other organizations couldn't use it because they had to build the stage on,
build a set on the stage, and then that becomes a storage depot, and then it becomes, I'm having worked in public schools, I'm aware of the complications that come out of all that, that's great. You have the performance coming up at the Rocket Arena on March 30th. Could you share some thoughts about that?
Yes, absolutely. John Legend, who is an award-winning singer-songwriter, is going to be airing on March 30th in the Rocket Arena within the O'Keefe Center on Canal Street. And he's coming as part of the Salem State series, which, as many of your listeners know, is a long-running as in this is our 33rd year, and popular Salem State series.
Oh, I know, so
he is coming at 7:30 on March 30th, and we have a special promotion, actually. We've sold quite a few of the 4,000 tickets that will fit into that arena. And this Sunday, we're having a special Oscars promotion that will allow people to get a free ticket with the purchase of any full-price ticket just by going online and entering the promo code Oscars. Okay. And the online is salemstate.edu/series. Okay. And then by putting in the word Oscars in the promotion line, then they'll be able to get a free ticket.
That's great. What are some of the other things that you have worked on, or you are working on, or that fall under the purview of VP of Institutional Advancement?
Well, when I related the fact that we had that we had our campaign, that we had just completed our goal towards our goal, we also, that's obviously not the end of our fundraising.
No, I'm sure.
You know, we're going to continue to raise funds as needed for the university, particularly establishing a more solid foundation for our annual fund. We also have, as part of our fundraising, have a very strong relationship with corporations, in particular in the North Shore and the Greater Boston area, and so those corporations have sponsorships of not just the series, but of many of our programs across campus. And there are many corporations who have supported initiatives on campus that are part of our huge success story.
Great. Is there, how much, if this was even something you can answer, but how much is the social, the evolution and emergence of social media helped you folks in terms of reaching out and connecting to alumni and getting them more involved or giving them to make a contribution or even sponsors that are not alumni?
Social media has definitely been a boon to our fundraising efforts. Institutional Advancement has a specialist in social media, and to reach out to our alumni and our friends who are also donors. So we have, obviously, a huge email campaign, but we have postings on Facebook. We tweet. We have text to give efforts that we might announce at some of our events. So we say, if you're in the audience and you haven't given yet, you know, here, text to give immediately.
Ah, that's great. That's great. Yeah.
Carried away with the emotion and the passion of the moment about Salem State.
That's wonderful. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest with us and sharing some of the great things that are going on at Salem State University. I hope the Oscars event that you have this weekend is successful, and certainly hope the other endeavors that you've talked about today continue to prosper for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being a guest on our show.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sarkisian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sarkisian Sportswear handles all aspects of your needs, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SarkisianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sarkisian Sportswear is the place to go.
Seat. You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street, a great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. Treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
This game is brought to you by the Institution for Savings, your local community bank since 1821, with great rates, great service, and great people. Harrington Trophy, rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years with quality products and service, located in Lynn and at harringtontrophy.com. Moynihan Lumber, of Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Sylvan Street Grill. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill. The Daily Item of Lynn and itemlive.com. Click on their banner on our website to access their respected news and sports coverage. Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our guest is Bob Grabino. Bob, welcome to the program.
Morning, Josh. It's nice to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I know when we had a different show, the Rotary Radio Hour, you were a frequent guest, but this is a little bit different audience, and so I'd ask you to clue us in and give us a little bit of your bio for us, a little bit of your background.
I'm originally from the shoreline of Connecticut. I grew up in Guilford, Connecticut. I went to the Coast Guard Academy at New London, Connecticut. Met my wife, Kathy, there. She was going to Connecticut College for Women. I then spent the next 30 years in the Coast Guard after graduation, receiving my degree and my commission. I spent 2 years on an icebreaker, breaking big pieces of ice, trying to get into places like Thule and Sandstrom in Greenland to resupply early warning defense missile sites, or radar sites, actually. Then I went off to Navy flight training and became a pilot and spent the rest of, majority of the rest of my career flying aircraft. I've flown two different types of helicopters, Sikorsky helicopters, big C-130s, and Falcon jets. C-130s were my last aircraft, and I flew it while serving as commanding officer up in Kodiak, Alaska, which was a great experience.
Wow.
Up the Coast Guard after 30 years and went into the municipal sector. I started out in Burlington, Massachusetts as Assistant Public Works, went on and actually worked in Gloucester.
Yep. Great. Back when Bruce Tobey was mayor.
Bruce Tobey was mayor, and some great city councilors, and just a wonderful group of people, and a real challenge.
And Bruce was in the Coast Guard himself. I'm sure he told you that.
That's right. He was a direct commission lawyer in the Coast Guard, and he was in the Coast Guard while I was in the Coast Guard, but I never got to meet him. But I enjoyed working with him and with the people of Gloucester. And after a couple of years, I moved on here to Ipswich as the public works director. I served 10 years here. We moved to Ipswich after I was served here, or was working here about 3 years. And I retired 4 or 5 years ago from that position. And since then, Kathy and I have been spending a lot of time volunteering and doing just activities in the community here and up in Maine, where we have a year-round home.
Now, I know that you're a Rotarian, because that's where I met you, through Rotary, although I want to say that I met you when you were DPW director, but I'm not sure of that. But anyway, tell us about, I know you're past president of the Ipswich Rotary Club, but you're also involved in a lot with the happens with the district, and you certainly show up with a crew when we do our polar plunge. So tell us what you do in Rotary.
As you said, last year I was the president of the Ipswich Rotary Club, and I've been a Rotarian. I was a Rotarian for 3 years up in Alaska in Kodiak, and then I joined Rotary again here in Ipswich in, I think, 2006. I've served on the district staff previously. I'm presently the membership chair, but before that I served as the Polio Plus chair and the annual giving chair in the Rotary Foundation, which is a great organization. And through the Polar Plus, I was able to, for 3 years, I ran the Polar Plunge over at Gloucester, got to know a lot of fine folks in Gloucester, in the Rotary Club and in the community, and got to be reintroduced to a lot of people in Gloucester.
Yeah.
I'd known a lot when I was over there, so... So I feel very close to Gloucester. We've raised significant funds for polio, for Rotary's project to eradicate polio worldwide. And actually, the Polar Plunge was started by, I believe, you were the president of the Gloucester Club in the first year. And
That's right. It was a fluke, really. Steve Cady, our foundation chairman, was at a district event, and somebody brought up the idea of a polar plunge, and he approached me and he said, "We get an idea that when I heard it, it had your name all over it, and I knew I was going to get conned into something. I said, what do I have to do? So we have to jump in the ocean in February. I said, do I have to stay there any amount of time? And no, just go in and come out. I said, well, I'm not going to do it for $50, but if you can raise $1,000, I'd do it. And, of course, in the context of that, he said, this is for polio and so forth. So after that, I went back to the board of directors that I served as the club president and said, you know, this some talk about this. Why don't we offer to host it? And we did. And we offered, and Joy DeGuzman was the district governor nominee, and Swami was the district governor-elect, I think, and we interfaced with them and Julia Phelps, and it just started to materialize. And so we had 35 of us that jumped in the first year. I think we raised $27,000, and it was no sense really that this was going to be an annual event, but I remember Joy at the time said, if this is done right, it'll be a fellowship opportunity, it'll be an educational opportunity, and it'll be a fundraiser. And actually, that's exactly what it has. It's really grown every year, and the fellowship piece is what people really look to. I mean, you see more and more people show up every year, whether it's people jumping in the water or people being there to support them.
Yeah, you when you did that, I think that was the 2010. Probably it happened in January, February 2011.
And yeah.
You were the president of the club, and Tony Carrero was the president elect coming in. You had some great people. You mentioned Steve Cady, and you had Steve Dexter, and
just
Julio Lafontaine, who's also very involved in both the Rotary Club and other things over there. And, It goes on.
And it's interesting you bring her up. She's, of course, she's the in charge of the executive director of the Open Door and the food pantry. And I know they've opened a branch in Ipswich, but I also know that you're involved in that organization too. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and what that role is?
Well, back maybe 3 or 4 years ago, our Rotary Club has always been involved in the Ipswich Food Pantry, which was a very small operation, and a couple of us looked at the food pantry and said, this is a great community activity. It serves a lot of people who are in need. It's just a great thing for the community. And we started looking around to see how we could help other than just our large contributions and the fundraising we did for it. And lo and behold, the food pantry, kind of on its own, had been talking to Open Door, and under the able leadership of the board of directors here and Julie LaFontaine, they did a beneficial, call it a merger of the two organizations. The Open Door has now been operating for over a year. They moved their operation from the basement of one of our local churches to a standalone building up at the Ipswich Housing Authority in Agawam Village. It's open 2 days a week and is serving a significant number of people here. And lo and behold, I guess because of my involvement, I was asked last year if I'd be interested in joining the board of directors, and decided that that was a very worthwhile use of my time. So now I find myself working again with a lot of people over in Gloucester on the Open Door Food Pantry Board of Directors, and just a huge number of volunteers, and a very rewarding experience. You know, they had their secondhand gift store, and I forget exactly what it's called over there, but it's just, you know, the people of Gloucester and
Rochester. Oh, and it's a facility of some significance in size and the amount of material that's there. You can get, you know, not just clothing, but furniture and other household things that people would need, and very impressive what they've been able to do with that.
It does. It's a great facility that, we believe in recycling today and trying to help the environment, and one of the big R's is reuse, and the people of the North Shore of Boston drop off a lot of their good articles, and they're reused and they're sold by the Open Door Food Pantry folks, and I think they're approaching sales of almost $1 million a year, and that's a big source of income for the Open Door in regards to continuing to provide their services. And if you've never had Julie LaFontaine on your program...
Oh, we have.
Yeah,
yeah. She's a regular.
She's a wonderful lady and does huge numbers of activities that are very beneficial to the city of Gloucester and the surrounding area.
She's very good friends with the Delvecchios in Gloucester, and she was sharing with me something about them, and I said, they live in the house that I grew up in. I mean, it's funny how small things are and connections. You know, back when we had the Lorain apartment fires, our Rotary Club got involved in trying to refurnish all the tenants, and we were able to do that with an initiative. But I remember thinking at the time it would be great if somebody had a workshop where people, maybe people who are retired or people who have time on their hands, could go and take the things that people discard and rework them so that they're functional now. The rocking chair that has only one rocker on it, or the couch that needs to be refitted, or the whatever, and then allow that to be resold to with a place that the Open Door has, but never could find the resources. I was hoping that one of the trailers that we had from DPW could be used for that, but it just didn't come together.
Oh, I think that eventually you probably, that's a great idea, and it's a great thing to pursue. So keep thinking and talking about it, Josh, on your show there.
Yeah.
Somebody will step forward and assist you on that project.
Well, let's hope so. Now, what are some of the challenges that you're finding in terms of membership? I know that you and I are born of the generation when President Kennedy said, ask not what you could do, your country could do for you, what you can do for your country. And it's brought upon a sense of volunteerism and people wanting to give back more. And you wrestle with, in different discussions in with groups that I've been in, and how much social media has changed the dynamic that, for example, created Rotary. Our people, whether it's Rotary or it's Kiwanis or the Elks or whatever, you know, 100 years from now, are people is that still going to be an interest for people to want to join those, or are we going to be shifting away from that? So I guess with that as a backdrop, how does that present itself in terms of the challenge of sustaining people to in way of membership, to wanting them or getting them to stay involved, or attracting new and younger people to want to roll up their sleeves and give something back the way you and I and some of our friends have?
You bring up a very good point there, Josh, and it's an issue that a lot of the nonprofits and organizations across the board are having difficulty with, and that's membership. The young people today are just as good as the generations that came before, but they're very interested in going and doing volunteer work, enjoying it, doing good things, and then getting out of it, and then go back a week or two later and do something else. So they still have the enthusiasm and the desire to help others, but they're not as much joiners and clubs like Rotary and some of the veterans fraternal organizations and other things where there was a lot more socializing. Young people have got a different desire. So the challenge to groups like Rotary, and Rotary is standing up to this, is to present an organization where people can socialize, but the real focus is on service to the community, doing good in the world. So Rotary is actually starting to do a metamorphosis here, a change where we're looking more at less of the attendance, say, at meetings, and more of people getting together and working on community projects. And that's been a challenge, but Rotary is really coming around. For instance, the Rockport Club has got a new option for membership in Rotary, and they call it service membership. And there's no real requirement to attend the meetings and dinners, but there is a minimal requirement to do that. But it's more focused on the service member folks come together to do service in the community. So I think Rockport has something like 10 or 15 service members. Once a month now, the Rockport Club meets at night, the first Thursday of the month.
When I was assistant district governor, that was one of my clubs, and when they were forming that and swearing those folks in, I was there. So it's a great group of people, and actually knew quite a number of the people there to begin with. So yeah.
And this helps people. If you're a school teacher, if you're somebody who works in Boston, or you don't have the time to take off at lunchtime
or breakfast, you're on your way to work, or there are certain. That's what been one of the problems for Rotary is that there are only certain professions are more likely to harvest people that can become Rotarians by virtue of the way it was set up previously.
Exactly. So now Rotary has got options where folks can, in fact, become a Rotarian and not be concerned about the requirements for finding the time in their busy schedules, whether because of children or whether because of work or other commitments, so that they can actually be very productive Rotarians and at the same time, meet their other commitments as far as family and work and that sort of thing goes. So it's really working out well. It's a big change, and if you've got any folks out there, anybody who's listening who might have an interest in working in the community and doing good in the world, as we say, maybe they can give you a call, and I'm sure you could put them in touch with the club closest to them and provide them with updated information on what Rotary is and what we're doing today. So, I think you're in a perfect position to do that.
Yeah, the thing that struck me, if you go back to the very beginning of Rotary, is the, I think we're getting chewed. We're going to have a... we're going to have to cut to the end here, but I'll save that story for another day, and
right.
I'll share it with you next time I see you. But I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, sharing your life experience and all the good work that you're doing as a volunteer in the community, be it with the Julie LaFontaine's program, the Land Trust in Maine, and the Rotary activities you're involved with. Bob, thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Josh. Enjoy talking to you, and have a great weekend. Spring
you too.
Maybe has arrived. Take care.
Take care. Take care.
Very good. So we had a few ghosts in the machine, but I think we've got them cleared up, I hope. And at any rate, you got some guests lined up for the future. We will not be here next week. We have next Friday off, but then we'll resume after that.
We have... Tiffany Bellerin, who is CEO and founder of Dreams Recycled.
Dreams Recycled.
Recycled. It's an interesting thing. You have to see it to understand it. But Leslie Gould is the executive director of the Lynn Chamber of Commerce. Mark Whittemore of Workforce Investment Board of the North Shore. Joanne Simmons, the executive director of Northeast ARC. Dr. Patricia Gentile will be back, who's the president of North Shore Community College, talking about the things we didn't get to cover on the first time she was on, and a representative from the company Beyond Booksmart.
I still want to know about Dreams Recycled.
I'll explain it to you when we get off the air. It's a little complicated, but it's good.
That's Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, producer and engineer Bill Proposky. Have a great weekend. We'll be back in 2 weeks at 10 a.m. with Trending Now. It's Josh Arnold. Don't forget to check out the website for all the latest information on North Shore sports news and newsmakers.